Okay, we're just about to start. We're just going to do a brief audio check. Good morning to everybody. We'll start just in about a minute or two. And once you hear the streaming audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen and hit send. That will confirm for us that you're picking up the audio stream okay. Of human perfection and different views of the afterlife. And we'll just take up some various points, just a few points today. And maybe touch on something that he wrote in his Shmona Prakam, the 8 chapters, as an introduction to the Ethics of the Fathers. And we're just going to wait one moment for friends to call in from Seattle, and then we'll start. Josh, how are you?
Hi, good morning, good.
Good. Okay, I sent you back an email regarding Rabbi Zucker's class. You're right, there was a wrong file name. That should be working fine now.
Okay.
And I also mentioned that Reza Shoshana is out of the hospital. She's doing well, thanks.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah. We're actually on the West Coast, so she's actually up and around, which is great. I saw her recently.
Oh.
Yeah, so she looked really back to herself. Really, really good news.
Oh, that's fantastic.
How are you?
We're doing well.
We're doing well.
Good. Josh, how's it going with you?
It's going good.
Okay. Actually, I've been in touch. I've been sending you some of the correspondences between me and Avram and Naomi. So it looks like they know this person, Sharon Galuskar. I think Sharon is a man, the way Avram was talking about him. Well, I thought it was a woman for whatever reason. I guess the name gave it away. But anyway, they've been in touch, and hopefully that'll start getting things rolling for them. So,
and is Sharon connected with a non-profit organization there?
Yeah, ORT. ORT is a woman's... ORT is either an Israeli-based or a New York-based Jewish group, mostly women. So hopefully they've got connections too, so I'm staying on top of it.
Fantastic. How did you make the connection?
I just looked around for different Jewish groups in India on Google, and I sent emails out to a number of them, and this was the only one that responded.
Wow. So I presume that if we wanted to get financial help to Naomi and Avram, that we could theoretically then do it through this organization.
I should, I would assume so. But I'll send to the list, to you, Jesse, Cal, Josh, what correspondence transpires, so everybody's in the loop. And anybody has ideas, you can correspond directly.
Okay, tremendous.
And actually with us today online is Bencion Rodriguez, who is of a Noachad group in Brazil. And he wrote me yesterday that they're really having a tough time because they accept, when you follow the truth, like the Maimonides says and what we're reading right now, the third group, or you know, the first group of people, the people that look at the rabbi's words, and they say that they're literal, and that's it. There's nothing more to it, which is foolish. And then the other group, the second group, which is even larger, are those who look at the rabbi's words and they say it's literal, and then they ridicule the rabbis because they feel that they know better. And the third group is what Maimonides says of the few, you know, just very, very minute individuals, very few people that are scattered around, and they are the ones that have the correct ideas, and they view the words of the rabbis as having tremendous wisdom. And they know that things have to be interpreted, and that there's underlying ideas, like King Solomon says, to understand the riddles of the sages. And Ben Sion, if you can hear me, just type okay on screen. I just want to make sure that everybody's picking up the audio. And he's telling me that since they reject the view of a Jewish superior soul, so the Chabad is not accepting them in Brazil. So because they have one ludicrous idea, these Chabad people, they feel that the Jewish soul is superior. You know, of course, it's baseless, and, you know, all facts go against that. It's pure ego that wants the person to feel this. So now they reject helping out the Noahites, you know, genuine people that really are taking a stand, and they're following what makes sense. I've been in touch with him in the past, and, Ben Sion straight. I mean, he's saying all the other ones, too, they want to follow properly, but they're not giving any credence to this group because they have no rabbi that's siding with them. So I told them, I'll certainly side with you, use my name, whatever. Okay, Alberto, thank you. Is that you, Ben Sion? Alberto? I'm not sure if it's the same person or not. So I told them to join us here since we're doing topics that are, you know, addressing, you know, what, you know, we could learn as Noahites. So he's on, and looks like Alberto is also here. I'm not sure if Sao Paulo is anywhere near Brazil. You're pretty good on that, Doug. What's the proximity?
Yeah, Sao Paulo is a major city in Brazil.
Oh, okay, good. So they're probably part of the same group.
Yeah.
Okay, Alberto, good to see you. Well, we're in line with Doug and Cal and Josh in Indiana and in Seattle. So we're all together here, the, you know, Noahide group learning, you know, topics that, of course, that they're fine to do. Okay, Alberto, you're welcome.
Rabbi, is that idea of the superiority of the Jewish soul a Chabad idea, or just a particular rabbi apparently there who happens to be Chabad?
No, it's actually in their book, the Tanya, which the Lubavitchers hold as, in my estimation, as important as the five books of Moses, which is completely foolish. And by the way, Alberto in Sao Paulo is saying hello to everybody from on screen.
Hi, Roberto.
And greetings, Roberto.
And yes, they say in that book there that there's a piece of God, literally, in every single Jewish soul. So it's right there in the book. It's not just which one person says. And what they do is they, I don't know, did we ever discuss this? That's a quote from Job. Did we ever take this up?
I don't think we did.
No? Cal, do you remember?
No.
Yeah, because there's a quote.
I read it on the side, but I don't know if we talked about it.
Yeah, let me tell you exactly where it is. It's, I think it's 32:3, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just look it up really quick. Let's just make sure. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, I addressed it a number of times, and I got some flack, evidently, because I'm going against their treasured book. Yeah, it's actually Job 31, verses 1 and 2. And he says as follows. He says, quote, "A treaty I have made with my eyes, for what shall I gaze at a virgin? And what portion shall I have with God above, and an inheritance of God on high?" So what Job was saying here to his three friends, they were trying to explain to him why he has such tragedies. And he was defending himself on numerous occasions, stating that he was righteous. In one occasion, he said here in 31, verses 1 and 2, he said that he made an agreement with his eyes. Meaning, whenever he looked for a wife for one of his sons, he said, "Why will I look any longer at a young girl, a virgin, more than necessary to estimate if she is, a good catch for one of my sons?" And then he says, "And what portion shall I have with God above? And an inheritance of God on high." Meaning, if I do this and I look longer than necessary at a woman, meaning I'm caving into lustful emotions, so now I'm going to be forfeiting my portion with God. So those words, if you translate them into Hebrew, what the actual words are, it says, when he says, "And what portion shall I have with God above?" would be, "Umah chelek elokim imal." So what they do is that book, the Tanya, they take those words and they say portion of God above, and then they add the word literal. So they completely distort the verse. The verse is really expressing Job's sense of piety. He's righteous. He says, "What portion will I have with God above if I would do this?" He's just explaining his sense that I would be outside of, you know, God's chosen people if I would sin. So what they do is they take that verse and those words, and where it says, "What portion would I have with God above?" and they say, "Portion of God above" means it's a portion of God in us. You see how they completely distort. It has nothing to do with the verse is saying. And it's foolish, because in my mind, he says, there's no parts to God. You can't divide God into pieces and put him into each soul. That's a heresy. But this is in their book. And they're Tanya. And they actually add the word literal. That's an order that you should not take this as being metaphoric in any way, but they actually believe that there is a piece of God in every person. Now, where does that come from?
Is the claim that it's just a Jewish soul, or...
Yes.
About all.
Yeah, they say that there's a Jewish soul. See, it's ego.
Yeah.
They try to...
Cause, I mean, even that doesn't... Because I know there's various opinions about Job, but at least according to some, you know, he was before the time of the Jews. Job himself wouldn't have been Jewish, right? I realize, like Imani says, you know, the whole story is like a metaphor, but...
Right. At what point is he placed in time? That's a good question. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Yeah.
Is that maybe by the time of Paro? Am I accurate in that? That's what they wanted to place him? Or was that...
I've heard that, like, around the time of Pharaoh. I've heard other things that maybe he was, like, contemporary of Abraham.
Uh-huh.
So that's where, like, I think Mahdi says, you know, the various different, you know, people place them in different time periods. This kind of shows, you know, nobody really, you might, you know, not even be a real person.
Right. Yeah, Alberto, Alberto is online from St. Paul, so he's saying that one thing is true, it's hard to understand how could a rabbi like the first Lubavitcher rabbi commit such a mistake. It's incredible. So, Alberto, the thing is, at least to give some credit to him, we don't know who wrote that. Maybe an editor put it in. We don't know if somebody who had certain leanings, you know, superior Jewish leanings, put that word in there. But the quote itself, I mean, that's a really bad quote. And if he did do it, it's a mistake. It's a real corruption. So, that's where it comes from, Doug. That's a real source right there. And it's in their book, the Tanya.
And I take it that Tanya is a Chabad book, not a generally accepted Jewish text.
Right. But so many more now, because people look at how widespread Lubavitch became, and they say, well, they must be doing something right. To that we say, well, look how far spread Christianity is. So, you know, it doesn't matter how widespread or popular. I mean, the whole dress, the whole thing is such a sham. Because why do they have to dress different? Why do they have to grow beards? What's with the black hats? This has nothing to do with Judaism. As a matter of fact, the opposite. It says it in one of the prophets, Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 8. it says that God punished the Jews who wore strange garments. And Radak, Rev. David Kimchi, a very brilliant mind, very straight, you know, real straight thinker. He's the one that spoke about how the idolatrous woman that King Saul evidently conjured up and brought up, you know, Samuel back from the dead. He explains it all as being just metaphoric. He does not take that as literal whatsoever, because, again, all, this is all nonsense. There's no powers in the world except for God, and whatever a human being does with his muscles, that's the only powers you have, meaning nature, you know, God's creations, God's intervention. But there's no such thing as these beings or clairvoyance or demons, all these things that are completely foolish. So Rev. David Kimchi, the Radak, that's the acronym, so he says, what does it mean in Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 8, that God punished the Jews that dressed, wore strange garments? He says, in his last opinion, that it means they tried to dress to look more righteous than the rest of their fellow Jews. Meaning the evil that these Jews did is they tried to use dress to try to present themselves as being more righteous, which is clearly what the Lubavitchers do. That whole thing about the beard, like there's some piety, and they even go to the point where a lot of them say that there's holiness in the beard, because they can't just do something without them saying it's connected somehow to a religiosity. So they have to create this nonsense. And that's why they don't even trim the beards, because there's some holiness. I mean, it's just such a ridiculous thing. And again, it's their attempt to be superior to the rest of the Jews. Look at us, we're different. We're holier. We got the beards. Is this the beards somehow is a spiritual thing? Completely nonsensical. I mean, he even says, I remember Rabbi Che talking and quoting once a Talmudic source that said that Moses' brother Aaron, when he trimmed his beard, so it was a miracle, the oil that was anointed on him, in the beard it would raise up a little bit. Whatever that means, it could be medrash, whatever, but the literal fact is that he trimmed his beard. He had to be presentable. So the greatest, Maimonides calls Moses, Aaron, and Miriam the three most perfected people ever to exist. And he trimmed his beard, there was no problem. So it's just a foolish thing to try to proceed. If you look at what they do, a lot of these things, you know, where people try to feel more pious, they do things that take place in a public forum, either things that are externally seen, like dress or beards, or events, or the earlier ones they had like. They were like in the middle of praying to God, when you're supposed to be, you know, humble and still and thinking about what you're saying, they would jump up and down and have all this, and they would say, yeah, this is good because we're expressing our feelings, but it completely against Jewish law. And it's disturbing to anybody else. It is foolish. You look like a moron jumping around in the middle of a prayer. So it's important that people do not succumb to things that are widespread, or have a big name, and they raise millions of dollars in the Chabad telephone. I mean, this does not endorse anything which goes against the Torah. It doesn't matter. But people are, unfortunately, very sucked into success and popularity. Now, let me see. Alberto's just writing on the screen. And another problem presented to us is the reincarnation theory, which is spread among Noahides like a way... that is spread amongst Noahides I'm not sure what you're saying there, Alberto. I guess you're saying that they believe in reincarnation. Yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, you have to realize where that comes from also. I'll ask you, where do you think? I mean, Doug, Cal, Josh, Alberto, Batsion, you tell me, Joel, JHS, and Mike. Where do you think the need for the belief in reincarnation comes from? The more we understand foolish beliefs and we see where they come from, the less of a grip it'll have on us, and the better we can help others and teach them. So where do you think the belief in reincarnation comes from?
Well, it would seem like it would come psychologically from a desire to maybe get out from under the responsibility of, I better get things right now, because if you say, well, if it doesn't go right, I can just come around again and I'll get it the next time, it seems like it removes some of your personal responsibility.
Exactly. Exactly. And people don't want that. Yeah, go ahead.
What the? Yeah, I agree with that point. I'd also add, I think it's an attempt to try to answer like questions of like why. It seems like a lot of times the points will bring up is like, well, why does something bad happen to, you know, like an infant or something? So, you know, they try to explain this by saying, it must have been something from a previous life. Or, which, you know, again, is maybe to try to put the, put the blame somewhere else. It's something I did in a past life, or, you know, instead of examining the life you have now.
Yeah. I mean, the big response to that when people say, people have this idea that you come back because they call it in Hebrew like tikkun. Tikkun means like to repair. So there's something you didn't do in your last life, and now you have to repair it, so you have to come back. So that's one of those theories. The only problem you have with that is what? What's the complete refutation of this theory that people come back, they are reincarnated in order to compensate for a mistake that they didn't address in their previous life? What's the complete refutation? And JHS, yeah, like people will come up with this because things they don't understand, so they make up new beliefs. You're right.
Well, what would be the point if you don't remember anything that happened in the previous life, so you're starting all over?
Exactly. That's the refutation. Very good. Alive today can recall being a previous person. And if you can't recall being that previous person, so you don't know the mistakes you supposedly have to repair. Exactly, Doug. And Alberto is asking what to do or how to answer when the Chabad cite rabbis or books to demonstrate reincarnation. Okay, well, first of all, Alberto, basic rule, because something is in print does not make it true. Like the quote Rabbi Chait, once we know something is true and our minds tell us it's true, we don't start running to print. Doesn't matter who the author is. You find something a great rabbi wrote and it seems to contradict what your reason tells you. If your reason tells you something must be, so you now don't abandon your reason because you found something in print. Okay, so that's foolish. That would be my response to anybody who tries to tell me, you know, I think that 2 plus 2 is 4. That's clear to my mind. Now you're going to find some big rabbi that says it's 5. He's wrong. Or I just don't understand what he's saying. But I'm not going to abandon what my mind tells me is true. And since what we follow today is the Torah, so we look at what Moses told the people. The opening of the Torah, it says that he tells the people that, behold, they place before you today life and goodness and death and evil. Meaning there's 2 choices you could make, that Moses is telling the Jews. And he says that this is the choice. I'm putting before you today life and goodness on the one hand, or death and evil. But then Moses says, but choose life. Now if Moses tells the people to choose life, that means that if you don't choose life, you have what? You have death, right? That means there is something which is fatal. There is something which is terminal if you don't choose life. So it's clear from Moses' words that if you choose the other way, you don't have life. And clearly, he's talking to people who are alive right now. So it appears that the life he's talking about is to have eternal life. But he doesn't say that if you choose the other way, that you can have a second option, that you can come back again. Where do you see that? And why is it that when Moses died, God hid the burial spot? If he's coming back, what's the use of hiding his burial spot? It won't be his burial spot in 10 more minutes. I'll be back. Or 10 more years, whatever. But you don't see any of this in the Torah. If we are true to what we're reading in the Torah, somebody passed away and he lied with his father, it says, by Jacob. And Abraham died and Isaac died. And that was it. There was no such discussions anywhere about the person coming back. And, right? Isaac didn't say when his father died, he's coming back. He's a prophet. So who do we follow? Do we follow Isaac, who's a prophet, and Jacob, who's a prophet, who never mentioned once anything about reincarnation, but they accepted that they died, and that's it? Or are you going to follow what the Chabad say with these beliefs of reincarnation and things that catch the emotions? You see that what they do is they try to talk up ideas that are emotionally pleasing, you know, mystical, Kabbalistic, all these different nonsensical things. And they can't stand on any one of these things. Not one of their ideas has a foothold, has any basis in whatever is sensible, and it completely goes against the Torah. Now, who are you going to follow? The Torah that Moses gave us, or a bunch of people running around today saying that there's holiness in your beard, and that all these other nonsensical things, that there's a piece of God? I mean, Maimonides says clearly it's impossible that there's a piece of God. You can't divide God. So it's a real crime.
That's one thing I can say, having come out of Christianity, and then I started learning about Judaism, and I read stuff on like Chabad websites and this sort of thing. And it's like, well, this is basically the same thing, because yep. You have, like, in Christianity, I was taught, the Christians have a piece of God in them, basically, that you get. Basically, it's, you have God living inside of you. That seems to be basically this idea of the, there's like some part of God, God forbid, in the human soul. And then also they have this whole, like, deification of the Messiah sort of concept.
Yeah.
Kind of messianic, fervor thing. Going on, which is like, well, this is just replacing one man with another man. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, to this day, I've never heard of any leader in Chabad outright tell people to stop putting notes in the rabbi's gravesite. This place in Elmont, New York, where the Lubavitcher Rebbe is buried. So if you go there, I've never been there, I've seen pictures, it's just filled, like a foot deep, with all people's prayers. So God is not the way you go anymore. Now, the dead rabbi. And of course, this didn't happen by the time of Moses, and that's why God hid his sight, in order that people shouldn't have any type of, I'm sure there's other reasons too, but I'm just saying that's a primary idea, I believe, that had Moses' burial site been known, people today would be sending notes there too.
Yeah. So I was in Safad a couple of years ago. I don't know what all the idea is behind this, but I mean there's goats, I'm assuming, are people's prayers, wrapped in plastic and tied on trees, like around the graveyard there, and all around the different grave sites, and obviously evidence of people have been gathering there and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, that's that they and they should speak out against it, but they don't do that. They don't speak out against it, so that's that commission is by their omission, by the fact that they omit to say anything against it. So they're contributing to the proliferation of these wrong ideas, and they should really put a stop to it. I mean, they go so far. I'm not sure who started it. There was a belief in the beginning of this whole Hasidic movement, where they believed that God is everywhere, which is pantheism. That's the belief called pantheism, where you believe God permeates everything. So it's the incapability of the human mind to just say, I don't know what God is, which is what we're supposed to say. That's why when we bless God, we say we bless the name of God. That's like Rabbi Chaid explained, we're saying that we don't know what God is. So we can't say we bless God. That would indicate we know what he is, in essence. So we only say we're blessing the name of God. All we know is his name. So it's an admission that we are completely ignorant of what he is. All we know is what God gave us to refer to him. But the original Hasidim, what they did was that they thought, since God is everywhere, he's even inside of sin. So that they allowed themselves to sin. They would even say that a person can sin because the fact that he'll bring himself down will catapult him to even higher levels. You know, again, ridiculous ideas. But it gave them the out to not have to follow the rigid system of halacha. So their inability to do that. They just justified it, and they cloaked it as if it was religiously true. And Alberto writes, what would you say if they argue that human reason is not able to understand the higher level knowledge like reincarnation theory? Well, if human reason can't understand a higher level of knowledge, so anybody in Chabad would not be able to tell you about reincarnation, because they should also not be able to use their reasoning against them, Alberto. And no, we don't accept things on faith. That's Christianity again. If that's what they do, that means that they're too ignorant to explain their theory, which is wrong. So what they do is they tell you, oh, you're too stupid to know something. So they're basically belittling you. But if they're saying that the human mind is not able to understand it, but it's true, well, how do they know that? So they're in a contradiction. And beware, they're going to get angry, because when you try to show them that they're wrong, forget it. That's a trend that I see. Because since they can't explain something, then they resort to the argument that, well, it's above human reason. You just have to accept with faith. But that's not what Moses said. Moses said to the people, don't forget what your eyes saw. Moses did not tell the people to ever accept anything on faith. So that's how I would respond back to him. But the truth is, if I were you, Alberto, I would not engage the Chabad in any conversations. Completely break off conversations, because they're not going to change. Okay, I just think it's just a waste of time, and really you should be using your time to go further and learn. You know, you learn the truths, use reason. Again, you know, God made a promise and he kept it, that the Torah is never going to be lost from the Jewish nation. So we have it today, and you know, we have to know what these fundamentals are, because the Torah is for everybody, all members of the human species. So let's just go back to the Torah, look at Moses' words, and we'll get the truth from there. All right, straight thinkers like Maimonides, Radak. What's going on today, what's popular, do not, you know, don't have anything to do with them, really. It's just a waste of time. And they're not going to change. All right, because they're looking at their holy rabbis and everything that's written, and that must be correct, even if they can't explain it. All right?
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
What about praying at the Western Wall, then? Is there nothing special about that compared to praying anywhere else? Or does that...
No, actually, God says at the end of in Exodus, the book of Jethro, so in that Parsha, the end over there, a few verses before the end, he says, in any place that you cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and I'll bless you. So there it's referring to, it doesn't matter where they built the temple, whether it's in Shiloh or whether it's in Jerusalem. So God's saying is, wherever I cause my name to be mentioned, meaning that wherever my name is associated with the temple, I will come to you and I'll bless you. So location doesn't matter in terms of God being able to understand a person's thoughts and his prayers.
So if one was in Jerusalem, then there is no real practical or rational reason to go pray at the Western Wall versus anywhere else.
Right, unless they want to say, again, I'm not fluent in this area about, you know, certain areas of sanctity. Is there, like, for example, it's better for a person to pray with a group of 10 men, because then, like Maimonides says, that those prayers are heard always. When you're praying, not on your own merit, but you're praying as part of the Jewish community, so then there's a different status. There's a different level of recognition. But it would have to be have something to do with that idea. In terms of, it wouldn't be the location per se, unless we want to say that there's a certain concept that you're better off. Like, for example, when we pray here in the United States, so we face towards Jerusalem. But that's in order to have a certain concept in the prayers. As a matter of fact, it also says when we pray, it's best if we pray at sunrise and sunset. Because there's another concept. Because since prayer is an approach to God, so if we pray when a very awesome event is taking place, which is reflective of God's creation, meaning the rising of the sun or the setting of the sun, that now embellishes on the one that we're praying to as being creator, and it instills in us a greater appreciation because now it hits our emotions properly. You know, there's nothing wrong with using our emotions for the right reasons. We're supposed to. So the Talmud says, or Rabbi Robert Kaplan told this to me many years ago, and it's based on the verse that they should fear you with the sun, meaning they should always fear you. I think King David was saying this regarding God, that the concept of praying with sunrise and sunset adds to the person's sense of awe, and that's one of the commands of the Torah, is to fear God. So when there is a benefit, like it also says, that the air of Israel makes one wise. So of course that's not literal, but it means the environment. When a person is in Israel and is always confronted with the events that took place in God's close relationship with those great prophets, so that awareness is on such a high, is peaked when you're in Israel as opposed to when you're outside of Israel. So that awareness will keep a person in tune with certain ideas. And when you're in tune with ideas, you're going to become wiser because you're contemplating things more.
I got it. Thank you.
Okay. And Alberto is saying, but the wall itself does not mean that God is more found in that location. There is more of the divine presence since it's not, since the destruction of the first temple is in it. I don't know, in terms of if there's more divine presence at the wall. Again, this is not even the wall of the Beis Hamikdash, of the temple. This, I believe, is what Herod built, if I'm not mistaken. My friend was just there for a month and a half. So the bottom line is that we have law. We have the Shulchan Aruch. We have outlines as to prayer is to be with a quorum of men, with 10 men or more. That is a person, and that's an added thing, of course. Of course, a person can pray alone. He can pray where he learns. That's also an added thing. If he's got one room in his house where he does his Torah studies, that should be where the preferential place for his prayer. Because then he's teaming his prayer with the concept of approaching God in terms of wisdom. And that's what prayer is. I mean, prayer is a very good thing because when a person prays for something, for example, number one, he's recognizing that God is the source of everything in his life. That's why he's praying. Number two, when things don't happen that he's asking for, then he can examine what he's asking for because that would now indicate that he's not asking for something which is good. Or maybe he doesn't have the right concept of what God is. So his prayers are meaningless if a person prays to God and he thinks God is a physical form of some sort, like the Chabad thing. So it's very important that you first have the right concepts of God. And there we go to what Moshe Rabbeinu, what Moses wrote, Maimonides. I mean, we know who the great thinkers are. We know who the ones that are complete compliance. And I'll quote something from Maimonides, just briefly soon, which is also just shows how careful he was in looking at the words of the rabbis, and that's how he derives beautiful insights, just by looking and being careful with how to read. Well, I'll give an example shortly on that. But let me just pause here and see if there's any other questions or comments. Doug, Cal, Josh, was there anything from last week? Any comments or questions you had?
Rabbi, the only thing I wanted to go back to on the reincarnation thing, it seems like man through the ages has always spent a lot of time and energy in immortality, and I wondered if the reincarnation thing tied into that belief that there's more than just we live and we die.
Yeah, clearly. I agree with you 100%. Person doesn't want to accept the fact that he leaves here because the unknown is very scary. But we discussed it last week that we shouldn't feel the way because look at what God gave us here. I mean, such a great existence. So many fruits and flowers and plants that are so delicious and fragrant and beautiful scenery and then birds of all different types with great sounds. I mean, that's one of the songs of the day we see on Thursday. We talk about how the music of the birds, just so many pleasant things. They just give man such a tranquility. I mean, the birds that chirp on the trees and the crickets at night when it gets cold, all these things are not annoying. They're just the opposite. It's a person hears a bird chirping. It sounds nice. It's pleasant to the person. Blue skies, sun is something which God designed us to look at with a sense of enjoyment. When we see giant mountains and lakes, why is our response, wow, enjoyment? That means that God designed us with that type of reaction. He made all these things. It's necessary to have mountains because without mountains, you don't have the crevices called valleys that will distribute water. So the gravity pulls the rain down from mountains. They collect in these riverbeds, and then those decline and branch out and go to other areas. So water that is raining in one location can still reach other more arid regions through this method. That's how Egypt gets all of its water, the Nile, and other places too. So that's in terms of necessity. But then when we look at these, the aesthetic is something which is very pleasing. So. And water is something which is refreshing and it's cool and fruits are delicious and there God designed us with feelings that we enjoy friends and he created something called a sense of humor and he created delicious tasting food like cooked meat, something which is a real enjoyable thing, and wine. I mean, why all this pleasure? I mean, and then we top it off with the most primary enjoyment, that's wisdom, the ability to perceive all of this and to ponder it and to have ideas. So we see that the life that we have here is designed to be completely enjoyable. So we should be assured that what happens in the next world has got to be of that same intent. It's the same God. So we shouldn't have this fear, but people do succumb to fear. And that's why they make up these things. And people do feel that they don't want to be culpable, like Doug said. So therefore, they come up with reincarnation. Well, they don't want to leave this world. But Maimonides, you know, takes that up, as we were talking last week. People have this idea that the next world will be where we are rejoined with our dead relatives, or we have food, meaning everything is interpreted in terms of here. And that's the mistake. All right, so you want to take up an interesting question?
Sure.
Right, I was looking through, Maimonides also wrote a very nice introduction, about eight chapters, it's called, actually that's the title, The Eight Chapters, or the Shmona Prakim, and that's in the introduction to Ethics of the Fathers, which is usually found in the Talmud Avodah Zarah, the Talmud, the tractate that deals with idolatry. And in that one is where the rabbis inserted this great work of the Ethics of the Fathers, the right character traits, six chapters of the Ethics of the Fathers. So on that, Maimonides gives an introduction, and he talks about eight different topics. The sixth chapter, he says an interesting thing. It's pretty short relative to the other chapters. And he titles this chapter, the difference between the righteous person, that level, and between a person who keeps the Torah system but is constantly fighting his instincts. So if we wanted to label the two, there's the righteous person, and then there's the one who supplements his instincts. Both of them are keeping the Torah exactly. But the question is the motivation or the attitude of the soul. So Maimonides quotes a number of sources, and it shows how, and the philosophers, and he talks about how it is the unanimous opinion that a person who has to control himself from wrong areas, from sin, and it's a pain for him to do it, is on a lower level than a person who naturally gravitates towards the good. Okay? Simple idea. The higher level person is the one who naturally gravitates towards the good. The person has to constantly be battling himself. It's a lower level. All right? Let me just read something for you here. 1 second. He quotes King Solomon. The soul of the wicked person is evil, and the happiness of the righteous person is in doing good. I mean, the righteous person is glad to do the good. It's not something that she has to fight against. And he also quotes another one where he says it's a gladness for the righteous to do justice, but it's bothersome for the ones who are workers of evil. And he says it's agreement, the prophets agree with the philosophers on this. This is a unanimously agreed thing. But then he says like this. He says, but then we started researching the words of the rabbis in this matter. We found words that say that those people who desire sin and long after them are better. And Alberto, I'll get to your questions in a minute. Let me just finish reading here, okay? So now Maimonides says, but if we started researching further, we found statements of the rabbis that contradict this. And it says that the people that have the longing for the desires, right, are actually better. And they're greater because they're fighting off desires, where the other people who naturally go to the good aren't fighting anything, so they have less merit. And they quote a Gemara in the Sukkah 52, side A, page 52 in Talmud Sukkah. And they say, anybody who's greater than his friend, his instincts are greater than his friend. And this is not even enough, Maimonides says. They even said further that the reward for the one who rules over his soul is greater because of the greater pain that it takes for him to control himself. And the rabbis in Ethics of the Fathers in chapter 5, Mishnah 23, they say the words, in accordance with the pain is the reward. And even more than this, Maimonides says, this is an amazing one. He says, it's like they're commanding you to desire sin. He says there's a statement of the rabbis that looks like it's saying that it's commanding a person to desire, not to do sin, but to desire. Because the rabbis say, they warn you, they say, do not say that it's not in my nature and I don't desire this sin. Right? And they said, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Simon the son of Gamliel said, a person should not say, I do not desire to eat milk and meat. You should not say, I don't desire to wear shatnez. You should not say, I don't desire certain forbidden relations with a certain woman or a man. But what should you say? The person should say, I do desire it. But what can I do because my Father in heaven has decreed against it? So Maimonides is quoting this statement of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel to say that, you see, the rabbis say just the opposite. You should admit that you have the desire for all these things. Of course, you can't do it. But that seems to fly in the face of the original statement that who's better off, a person who naturally desires the good or a person who naturally desires the sin but has to control himself. So Maimonides' first quote was that the philosophers and the prophets all seem to agree. One who is naturally inclined to the good is much more perfected than the person who has to control his instincts. That seems to be the better person, is the naturally pious person. Whereas here, it's just the opposite. And he says that this appears to be a complete contradiction. All right, does everybody see the contradiction?
Yes.
Okay. So what do you want to say? One of the most powerful questions.
Well, it seems like there's an aspect of it that if a person naturally goes toward the good, so they don't have to fight off any instinct.
Right.
And I'm presuming it's not like they got there over time. It's just their natural temperament or personality is, that doesn't really affect me, and I just naturally go toward the good. Then that's a better state to be in, but it would seem that you achieve the most by having to struggle against something, and the struggle itself makes you strong.
Okay, so that's the second side.
Right. So that the person who has to actually struggle against it is and work against that instinct, it is developing a strength of character against the temptation of sin that will surpass the first person because they never had to struggle against it. And the second issue, and I don't know if this one is fair, is that I believe that it was said once somewhere in so many words that there's like a strong personality and then a not so strong personality, or a person with a lot of energy and a person not. And a person with a lot of energy depends on where they direct it, but they're either going to do a lot of evil or they're going to do a lot of good. And so it almost seems like the person who is just naturally drawn toward the good stuff would not necessarily have the same level of energy as someone who has to actually battle with their evil inclination.
I don't see why that's true. Why can't I say a person is naturally drawn towards the good with a tremendous level of zeal? So then you'll...
What makes them naturally drawn that way?
People have different dispositions. We've met people in life who are gentle, and we've met people in life who are abrasive. And then you have all the other areas of personality.
Okay, I see. I would agree with that.
But this.
I would say that the person who has to struggle to get there is, their reward is going to be greater because of that struggle. But in fact, it doesn't negate what Maimonides said at the beginning, because you actually would be in a better state to be naturally drawn toward the good.
So then that's the contradiction then. You're telling me that it is better off to be naturally drawn to the good. So you're not resolving the contradiction, you're just supporting it now.
Well, so is Maimonides saying at the end that the reward is greater for the person who rules over his soul, or that the perfection of the soul is greater, if you see the...
Right, the latter. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a contradiction. They have to be talking about apples and apples. meaning in one case, the greater person is the one who's naturally drawn towards the good. The other statement of the rabbi is that the greater person is the one who has to fight his instincts. Let me give you a hint, because I think it's going to be almost impossible to get the answer without one thing that he says. I had the same difficulty, because where do you go? I think there's one more fact that you need. He says like this. He says that, again, and I wanted to mention, I mentioned earlier that if you, Maimonides is so good at taking the words of the Torah and the rabbis and showing you the answer right from the words. So he says, the rabbis in the second case did not say that a person should not say that I hate killing, or I hate stealing, or I hate lying, but what can I do? My Father in heaven has decreed that I shouldn't do it. That's not what the rabbis said. They said you should say, meaning to say, the statement of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was, he says, don't say that you don't like milk and meat, that you don't like wearing certain clothing, that you don't like certain sexual intercourse. You shouldn't say that. You should say that you do want it, but what can I do? My Father commanded me against it. So Maimonides says, now look at what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said. He didn't say that you should say, I don't like killing or lying or thievery. He said that you shouldn't deny eating, clothing, sexual areas. He says you should say you do want it, but you can't do it. He said that a person should admit that. Right? So what is he trying to tell you by making that comparison of what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel really did say and highlighting those three things, the eating and clothing and sexual area? That's what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said that you shouldn't deny, but you should say you do desire it, but I can't do it because God commanded me against it. And he says, for example, what didn't Rabbi Shimon Gamliel say? He didn't say to a person that you should deny a desire for killing and lying and things of that nature. Well, what is Maimonides trying to do there?
Rabbi, I'm confused between setting the facts up here on the essence of what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is saying and what Maimonides is saying, because it sounds like they're saying the identical thing.
Okay. Maimonides is trying to resolve the contradiction. The contradiction is that the first instance, the first number of statements we find in the Torah and the rabbi's words is that the greater person is the one who naturally desires the good. The second set of things we find in the Torah, that he says after we research the matter, is that it seems it's the opposite. The greater person is the one who has the greater instincts. And that, in fact, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said that you should say you do desire milk and meat and shatnez, you know, prohibitions and prohibited sexual relations. A person should say, I do desire. You shouldn't deny those desires. You should admit them, but accept that you can't do it. So Maimonides now says, you see that there's two different ways that we can assess who's greater, but they're in contradiction. The first set of statements indicates that the higher level person is the one who naturally cleaves to the good. The second set says the higher person is the one who naturally cleaves to the bad. So we're in a contradiction. So far, so good?
Right.
Okay. Then he says we can resolve it if we look at these words. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and he says like this. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's statement was that a person should not deny the appetitive and the sexual and clothing, meaning like, you know, ego desires. A person should not deny that he has them. But he should say, I do desire these things, but I can't do it because God told me not to. So Maimonides says, look at those words of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel did not say, don't desire murder or thievery. He didn't say that. He says, don't deny the sexual, the appetitive, and the ego, is what he said. And Maimonides says from there, from what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omitted, you can get the answer to this contradiction that we have.
Okay, so I don't have those in front of me, but it sounds like what Maimonides is saying is that in Shimon ben Gamliel, he listed out a bunch of things, and that Maimonides is zeroing in on a subset of those?
No, he's zeroing in on those things as an exclusive group to the exclusion of other things.
Oh, so why did Shimon ben Gamliel pick those things?
Exactly. Why did Shimon ben Gamliel pick eating and appetitive, you know, the appetitive drive and the sexual and clothing? Why is that what he picked as being a praiseworthy thing that a person should not deny that he has those things, but no, it's just the opposite. He should admit that he desires these things. Don't lie. These things are good. They smell good. They look good, the shotness clothing. It would feel good. It would be enjoyable to have intercourse with one of those forbidden relations. But don't do it because God commanded you. But at the same time, don't deny that you have those desires. So it's only those three. So my mind is asked, why those three? Why didn't he say, I don't desire killing or stealing, things of that nature?
Okay, I'll take a shot.
Good.
So we're down to eating and clothing and sexual.
Right.
So eating and sexual are the two biggest instinctual appetitive instincts, and clothing is all about the ego.
Right.
So those are like the three biggest things that will drive a person.
Yeah. Agreed.
Now where to go?
It seems like things like murder and thievery and that sort of thing, there's an element of like cruelty, you know what I'm saying? Like there's an element of like aggression towards other people, whereas the other things are sort of, you know, natural drives, I guess.
Right. Therefore?
I would think it would be, you know, not a good thing for a person to be, say, naturally cruel, but, you know, something like, you know, milk and meat, it's not something that somebody would readily see as, this is cruel, it's wrong, it's more of like a, a restriction upon something like eating, which eating is not prohibited, whereas something like murder, you know, would always be prohibited. I don't know if that makes sense.
I'm not sure what you're getting at.
Yeah, okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is it that the person who has to overcome these is greater in that he is having to struggle to do that, and so, if I can put it in these terms, you get huge points, if you will, for overcoming your natural desire? But that at the same time, the person who's naturally drawn to the things that are righteous is therefore not going to have his energy siphoned off by that struggle, and is going to be able to devote more time into learning, and therefore is actually better off. Whereas the person who has to struggle against these will hopefully be successful in the struggle, but it will take time and energy away from their ability to learn. something in there connected with that.
So you're saying what? That the person who now has to... Again, say it again.
The person who has to struggle against these instinctual areas,
right,
is given great reward for overcoming them. But that struggle itself takes a huge amount of energy and takes energy away from learning that could otherwise be done.
So it sounds like he's on a lower level. But hey, Maimonides is saying he's on a higher level. Alberto, I see your questions on screen. I'll get to them. It's an important question. I'll get to it in a moment. Yeah, but you're saying, Doug, is that, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
Let me read you what he says. Let me read you what
he says. Another shot here?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Josh.
Okay, I can remember my thoughts here. There's things like dietary restrictions, but the purpose of the commandments would be to perfect the person, right? Because, you know, they would have to, you know, to fight against their desires and, you know, intellectually see, this is, you know, I desire this thing, but God commanded against it. So if it's something that the person naturally does not like, then, like if somebody doesn't like Brussels sprouts and God commands against Brussels sprouts, they really are not gaining any perfection there, right? Because they wouldn't eat it anyway.
Okay, good.
So, I guess that's in the case where, you know, you have the person that's better off, you know, having the desires there. I mean, and is there, are they saying for sure that there is, you know, there are people who would not desire these things naturally?
No, he's not addressing that at all.
Are they saying that this is stuff that everybody naturally desires and a person would basically deem that the dishonest to say that they don't?
That's right.
So, you know, in this case, then, like, the person that says that they don't desire these things would basically be a liar.
Correct.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah, so that can't be good.
Right, you're onto it. You're onto the answer.
Yeah, so, I mean, at least this person is honest with themselves and they can deal with something.
Right, that's what he says. I'll just fill in the blanks of what you just... What you're saying is like this. Let me just read Maimonides here. He says, but really, both of the statements are true. When he opens up with his answer now, right? We have the contradiction, but now both of these statements are true. And there's no argument at all between them. Okay. And he says, one who does not desire... is a desire, and he's much better off than one who has to supplement his desires. That was the first case, right? But what is that referring to? What category of desire? That's where he makes his opening to the answer. These are matters that are known, the public. Everybody of mankind knows that they're evil. For example, killing, right? And stealing, and thievery, and oppression of people, and hurting those people who didn't hurt you, and causing evil to those people who did good to you, and to embarrassing your parents, and similar things. Meaning this category of things are things that people don't desire naturally. So a person, when we say is better off, he's more perfected, it's a person in these areas, which he refers to as mitzvah. There's two things the Torah has, commands and statutes. Statutes are things that, had we not commanded them, they wouldn't be wrong. And he'll say that in a moment. Like eating milk and meat, would there be nothing wrong with it, had God not commanded it. Wearing shatnez, nothing wrong with it. Having intercourse with your sister, nothing wrong with it, had God not told you that this is prohibited. But killing and embarrassing people like your parents, and hurting people who did good for you, a person naturally won't do, and therefore that person whose natural inclination is to do the good, he's a much higher level than somebody who has a sick soul and has to sublimate it in order not to kill. Or a sick soul that is always stealing, or a sick soul that is hurting people that do good for him. So there we clearly see that who's the more perfected person? The one who naturally does not want to do any of these things. Right? And these are called mitzvahs, he says. Okay. Then he says, had these things not been written in the Torah, it's fitting that they should be written, because these are things that everybody comprehends you need in society. Okay. And he says, there's no doubt that any soul that longs to do any of these things, that it's a sick, it's a lacking soul. And the higher level person, the more important soul, is the one who doesn't desire from these evils at all. And he's not in any pain when he can't steal. He's not in any pain when he can't embarrass his parents. He's not in any pain when he can't murder. All right? But the matter is which the rabbis, the wise men, said that when you sublimate your instincts, that you are a higher level and you have a greater reward, those are things that it's called the Torah, meaning that if the Torah had not written them, right, they would not be evil at all. And because of this, they said that a person should So he's saying that a person shouldn't deny the fact that he lusts for them, but he holds back because my Father in heaven told me. And that's why he says that they did not say that a person should deny his desire for killing and stealing and lying. But they said, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, a person should not deny his desire for food and ego, wearing clothing, shatnez, or sexual. See, that's wrong for a person to deny it. Those are the natural tendencies in a human being. And they're with us from the day we're born to the day we die. So that's what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, don't deny these things. Accept that you have them. Be a person who follows truth. But your Father in heaven told you not to do it. So that resolves the problem. When we're talking about a higher level person is the one that doesn't long for certain things and he naturally follows it, that has to do with areas that a person doesn't have a longing for. And you instinctively know that this is not a good thing. To kill another human being, because you don't want to be killed yourself. To steal, because you don't want to be stolen from. Right? Or to lie, or to embarrass your parents that you naturally have an emotional attachment to. Or if somebody gives you money, that you smack them in the face. These are things that are completely contrary to normal human nature. And if a person has a tendency to do these things, and he has to sublimate himself, then he's a worse off person. So there, the person is after the truth more. In both cases, what really this boils down to is the question is, who is the person who's more in line with reality? It depends. So the answer that Maimonides gives, it depends on the subject matter that we're discussing. If the subject matter, however, is about natural desires, a person should not lie and say he doesn't want them. He should say he does want them, but he controls himself. A person who says, oh, I don't desire sexual intercourse, is a liar. It's impossible. A person doesn't desire delicious foods, he's a liar. And my mind just concludes by calling this a very wondrous point. Okay. Let me see if there's any questions or comments, and then I want to take up Alberto's question. He has a couple of important notes on screen.
Last question, Rabbi. The reference that you were reading is Maimonides on his commentary on
his introduction to, it's called The Eight Chapters, is the actual title, and it's in the introduction to his commentary on Ethics of the Fathers.
Okay. And I assume you were reading from an English translation, so it's available.
No, I was reading from Hebrew, but thank you for the compliment.
Oh, okay.
But thank you for the compliment.
Okay.
I would bet you that Fred Rosner probably has something on this, too. I think he does.
Okay.
Do I have it here?
That's all right. Cal tells me she thinks we have it.
Yeah. Let's see.
Amazon again.
One here. What is it? Ethical writings. Let's see what we got here.
Yeah, I think you're right. The ethical writings.
Yeah, here it is.
Yeah.
Trees and logic. Ethical writings. All right. Okay, all right, now let me take up Alberto's question. He wrote as follows. He says, I mean, we call somebody a tzaddik. Let me go up higher. So who is the one we can call a tzaddik, since he, like us, is possibly sinful, if he has the same desires we do? Why is there such a thing called a tzaddik? Meaning, you know, there were a lot of groups in Jews that referred to somebody who's like a person without sin. And Alberto was asking, based on what we're saying...
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So he's saying, should there be no true tzaddik then? No one who's truly without sin, since we are all the same level of desire and temptations? I mean, we call somebody a tzaddik like a great man, but if he is possibly sinful like all of us, all depends on your choices that are made. If right or wrong, it transforms someone from a tzaddik, a righteous person, to a Russian, to a wicked person. But what is the comparison with desire for food and desire for take someone else? Okay, that's something else. All right, so to answer your question, Alberto, about tzaddik, nobody is immune from sin. And that's what King Solomon said. I think it's chapter 7, verse 11, in his work called Ecclesiastes. And he says, for there is no man who is righteous in the land who does good and does not sin. For there is no man who is righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. Truth is that even Moses, the most perfected person, sinned. So there is this concept, and again, this is also part of the Chabad, that whole way of thinking, like the Christians have a saint. People want to look at this person as being pure, and therefore anything they tell me is going to benefit me because they have to be right. Since everything they do is right and they never sin, this is completely false. I mean, the greatest people make mistakes and the greatest people make sins. We just read this. Maimonides quoted the rabbis. It says, the person who is the greatest person has a greater instinct. Meaning, that how did the person get to be so great? It's because the instinctual drive is very powerful. So he was able to harness his instincts and use it in the right area and become a great person. But the idea of like this infallible person who's a tzaddik and never makes a mistake like they have with all their rebbes is completely Christian in nature. It's completely, you know, the deification of man. And whatever the rebbe says is absolutely right. Well, that's not true. If the rebbe didn't study a certain area, he can't give you advice in that area. So it's foolish for a person to go to a rebbe and ask him advice for business if he doesn't really know the workings of that business. You go to a person who is well-versed in that area. Okay, so to answer your question, no, we don't see this type of a concept. I mean, Moses was openly punished in the Torah. So why do people today make up stories about infallible human beings? Again, it's the infantile need to have a perfect, pristine father image. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for the instinctual state where when they were a child and their father or their mother did everything for them, and it was like a superhuman type of a view. That's where idolatry comes from. Looking for the replacement of that infantile image that we had when we were younger. but they can't emancipate themselves from that type of a instinctual and infantile need, so they carry it over, and they project all these things onto the rabbi. And even though he's dead, he's coming back, and we could send notes to his grave. It's all part of the same sickness. Okay. Again, we were honest, and we keep to the words of the Torah, and we think about what we hear. I think we'll stay on a good path, and we won't make any major errors. Again, listen, we're all fallible, so we can make mistakes in life, but you know, we have to review what we learn, we have to discuss with others, and you really put it to the test of, does this idea make sense? Is this something which goes against something which Moses wrote in the Torah? Does it go against reason? Okay. All right, so I think we have a few more minutes. Any other questions or comments? Do we see the answer clear, everybody?
Go ahead.
Josh, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Were we going to go back into the commentary on Tractate Sanhedrin sometime then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Did you get a copy of that?
Yeah.
Great.
I've been reading through it.
Yeah, read through it then, you know, if during the week, you know, either you or Cal or Doug, if you have questions on it, if you want to just write some notes down, and you want to take up different points in it. But I would, for sure, you know, read the whole thing by next Sunday.
Talking just chapter 10, basically, or?
Yeah. The one that we were doing was, what's my note?
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
Yeah, that was... yes, chapter 10. So read through the whole chapter, and Alberto, you know, you as well, and if your group over there, and Joel, whoever else is joining us, we're going through Maimonides' commentary on the Mishnah, and it is on Tractate Sanhedrin, and we're doing his commentary on chapter 10. So if you could all read it for next week, this way we can take up points. So have questions. What I'll do is I'll just take up your questions next week on that. All right? How's that?
Okay.
All right, so you read through it. Doug, is that good, Cal?
That'll work.
Okay, so look through it, you know, really go through it. If you need clarification during the week, let me know. I'd be more than happy to know. Give a call, email, whatever's good for you. And let's go through that. And then maybe what we'll do is we'll go back to what we just did today and go into his writings on the introduction to ethics, which is, you know, again, it's all about perfection, so this is something we can do. All right?
That works. And Rabbi, I would like to just touch again next week on Alberto's question about where is the dividing line when someone is called a tzaddik, given that I didn't quite get clarity on that.
Okay, sure. So why don't we start with that? We'll start with that question next week. You know, what exactly do we believe in this concept of a tzaddik, of a, you know, completely righteous person that doesn't sin? I mean, primarily we don't. That's the straight answer. We don't say people are infallible, and people who have this view, it's not true. It's coming from an internal, infantile need.
Right, and that point's clear to me. It's just then, given that point, it's not clear to me. So, what do we mean by a tzaddik then? Given that we all have those desires.
Well, that's what that means. At a certain point in your life, you could be living like a tzaddik. So that's talking about a certain moment or a certain, or maybe a certain point in your life when you finally reached that level after you've, you know, had decades of mistakes. But again, that's God to decide, not for us.
Hmm. Okay, so it's more of a concept, sounds like.
Right.
Okay.
That's for God. It's up to us just to live the best we can, not to give, you know, appellations, you know, labels to people. That's for God to determine. We have to live properly, be kind to other people, do justice, righteousness, charity, and continue learning and do the best we can.
All right.
All right, so we'll pick up next week, same time, 11:15 Eastern.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, as always.
All right.
Great week,
everyone.
Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks.